KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1
Funding
FM.
Funding for Here and Now
King
comes
Cove.
From MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink Software, accelerating
FM
the pace of engineering and science.
KF.
Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR
on
and
FM
WB.
Falls Pass and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Good evening. Called the meeting for episode 3.
So more than 100 lawsuits.
The
president's sweeping changes to government. Should federal courts be able to block those policies with one nationwide injunction?
These stories and comedian John Mulaney famously has used his past addictions as fodder. Now he's got a talk show.
That's right. We're all here. It's my live, jazz-like, unpredictable talk show. I can't do Coke or Adderall anymore, so I'm making it your problem.
Coming up Here and Now.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lara Singh. The Trump administration is appealing a court order to offer thousands of fired probationary workers their jobs back. Yesterday, a U.S. district judge in California ruled the dismissals across half a dozen agencies, including the Departments of Defense, Agriculture, and Treasury, were unlawful. NPR's Emily Fang reports the court's giving the government a week to comply.
In mid-February, thousands of probationary federal workers were fired, many for alleged poor performance. Unions representing those workers sued, and this week a federal judge ruled that those firings were unlawful. U.S. District Court Judge William Alsup said the firings targeted probationary workers, including veteran employees who had just been promoted, because they had the fewest employment protections. Alsup ordered six government agencies to give jobs back to probationary employees. But White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said the judge was abusing his power to, quote, thwart the president's agenda. And within hours of the ruling, the Trump administration filed an appeal. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
Within hours of the ruling from San Francisco, another federal judge in Maryland issued a 14-day stay in a case brought by 20 Democratic attorneys general. In this case, the order to temporarily reinstate thousands of workers applies to 18 federal agencies. The battle over the fate of the U.S. Department of Education is playing out this morning. Protests in Washington involving educators and other personnel who were recently laid off as part of President Trump's push to shutter the Department of Education. Meanwhile, the administration's investigating more than 50 universities for alleged racial discrimination as part of the government's quest to end diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Trump advocates say DEI initiatives have discriminated against white and Asian American students. A top official from the British government is scheduled to meet with President Trump's National Security Advisor today in Washington to talk about Ukraine. Here's NPR's Lauren Frayer in London.
Britain's National Security Advisor Jonathan Powell is meeting his American counterpart to try to pitch the Trump administration again on security guarantees for a possible European peacekeeping force in Ukraine. Britain has offered to send troops and jets to Ukraine in the event of a ceasefire, but it wants some kind of guarantee that if Russia were to attack them, the U.S. would intervene. And that's something the Trump administration has not agreed to. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer is nevertheless hosting a virtual summit Saturday of what he says are about 25 Western leaders who've said they're willing to join a, quote, coalition of the willing for Ukraine. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up nearly 600 points. This is NPR News. Mark Carney's swearing in as Canada's 24th prime minister during a ceremony today. The former central banker has vowed to safeguard Canada's economy from the escalating trade war with the U.S. President Trump maintains the tariffs he's ordered on steel, aluminum, auto parts, alcohol, and other imports will support manufacturing at home and restore a trade balance with other countries. But many economists fear higher tariffs could lead to a recession this year. Gold prices top $3,000 an ounce for the first time ever. Many investors rattled by economic and security uncertainties since President Trump took office and gravitating to safe haven assets. looking likelier that a volcano near Alaska's largest city will erupt again. From member station Alaska Public Media, Wesley Early reports it's been more than 30 years since a similar eruption shut the Anchorage airport.
Officials with the Alaska Volcano Observatory say research flights over Mount Spur in the past week detected increased gas emissions from the volcano about 80 miles west of Anchorage. Research geophysicist Matt Haney says an eruption from Spur is likely in the coming weeks and months.
More often than not, we have explosive eruptions that fragment magma and shoot ash, 50,000 feet into the atmosphere.
He says the most immediate hazard to nearby residents from a Mount Spur eruption would be from ashfall, which could be carried by winds into nearby communities, including Anchorage. For NPR News, I'm Wesley Early in Anchorage.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Insperity, providing HR services and technology, from payroll, benefits, and HR compliance to talent development. Learn more at Insperity.com/HR Matters. And the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Tiziana Deering in Boston. It's Here and Now. And David Cash is here in the studio with me. He was the EPA's New England Regional Administrator until January. Welcome back, David.
It's great to be back.
It's great to have you, and you're here because the EPA has announced plans to dismantle climate regulations in what it calls, quote, the greatest day of deregulation in U.S. history. That rollback includes a move to overturn key findings that underpin the regulation of greenhouse gases. These are big implications, David. Why is the new EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin doing this? Is it part of this smaller government vision, or is this about easing energy production?
Well, I'm not sure it's about either of those, but I think the result will be that we will not be holding polluters accountable, and maybe that's part of what they want. And for all of us, that means dirtier air, dirtier water, hurtling faster toward the climate crisis, and missing the lower costs and innovation and green jobs that would come with moving to the clean energy future.
So I didn't expect you to be pleased. Clearly you're not.
No, I'm not.
I want to come to this air pollution thing in a minute. But first, for listeners, let's just briefly have you tell us what the EPA is proposing to do here.
Well, what they want to do is roll back many regulations, someone on the order of 30. The big one is, as you mentioned, the climate change endangerment finding. Essentially, in the mid-2000s, with support of the Supreme Court, the EPA found that CO2 and other greenhouse gases essentially endanger people. All you have to do is think of the wildfires. You can think of hot days where people have more asthma attacks and the general damage to the environment and to public health from climate change. And so under the Clean Air Act, the EPA has a right to regulate that then, and that's exactly what the EPA has been doing.
So I want to talk in this air pollution space. And as I understand it, we've got what we used to know as air pollution, smog, particles, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then we have, with this endangerment finding, this idea of climate air pollution, greenhouse gases. I think pollution is something we can all get our heads around. So if these deregulations go into effect, what impact will we see on air quality, David?
Air quality will go down.
How and why?
So CO2 is one of the pollutants that comes from your tailpipe. It comes from a power plant, but so is soot, particulates, SO2. You've probably all heard of those. Some of those cause local public health problems, like greater asthma attacks. We'll see more of those. More cancer, we'll see more of that. More heart disease, we'll see more of that. But we'll also see the things that pollute the atmosphere that cause climate change to increase as well. And so we'll see greater storms, more wildfires, greater sea level rise, all of those kinds of things as well.
So let's take the counterpoint, David Cash. The new EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin says, this is about prices, jobs, a new golden age, as he put it. Is he right that there are at least parts of this that could be good for the economy, good for people's pockets?
So EPA has the role to protect human health and the environment, but it does so based on its regulations that protect industry as well. And the kinds of investments that have been made, particularly in the last 4 years, not only protect our human health, not only protect the environment, but have driven huge investments all over the country in urban areas and rural areas, in places where people want to move to clean energy and invest in them. It's not a surprise that a group of farmers sued EPA today because they were supposed to be getting some of the climate change grant funding that's been illegally frozen.
Okay, so stay with me, though. Have these changes over the last few years made anything harder that shouldn't be harder? Every organization has stupid rules, right? Mm-hmm. And unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Is there anything, for example, that you've wanted to see happen that might actually get easier as a result of these rollbacks?
I'm not sure of the ones that I've seen. I don't think so. I mean, all of the processes that we went through in the Biden administration that take many, many months, engage many different stakeholders, have industry at the table so that these regulations can be designed in such a way that can protect what the air you breathe and the water you drink and do it in a way that industry can come along. And then many industries like the automotive that have been excited to see the regulations that provide clarity and certainty about what they should be making investments in, which is why electric vehicles.
Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
An investment by the Alaska Permanent Fund in the seafood processing company Peter Pan was supposed to be an investment in Alaska, but it ended in failure to the tune of more than $29 million. That's because Peter Pan collapsed, resulting in the closure of the fish processing plant in King Cove, where it was the community's main economic engine. While the players are still sorting through the Peter Pan debacle, there are some big questions about whether the $80 billion permanent fund, the state's largest source of income, which also pays residents an annual dividend, should even be investing in Alaska-based companies. Nat Herz with the Northern Journal, in collaboration with ProPublica and the Anchorage Daily News, recently wrote about the Peter Pan failure. Herz says an investigation revealed that permanent fund leadership and its hired investment firm, McKinley Capital Management, either missed or ignored some warning signs that Peter Pan was a risky investment. He recently sat down with Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove.
The job that McKinley, the finance firm, was doing on behalf of the Alaska Permanent Fund was basically going out and looking for companies that sort of had growth potential or were undervalued and that they could sort of buy into and generate more money and sell it off at a big profit. And so one of the companies they ended up focusing in on was this Peter Pan Seafoods, which was like a longtime corporation that bought and processed and sold the catch of Alaska fishermen. And so they have this enormous plant in King Cove, this small community way out there on the Alaska Peninsula. They had a few other plants kind of scattered across the state. So the idea here was, okay, we'll put new money into these plants, like buy new processing equipment maybe and buy more seafood and raise the level of revenue and throughput in the plants, and then we'll have like a much bigger sort of book of sales and we'll be able to sell the company for a big profit.
I mean, that sounds great. So what's the problem with that?
Well, it does sound great, but generally speaking, the seafood industry is like a really chaotic and volatile industry where you kind of have like boom years and bust years. And so the idea that you could sort of easily build your revenues up and just sort of sell it for a profit, like this is a cutthroat industry. It has a lot of other existing players that are trying to maximize profits. And the other thing that really happened here was you had this kind of overall meltdown in global and Alaska seafood markets. And so like this reformulated Peter Pan like ran right into that.
It sounds like there were some red flags that were missed, but did you see anything in terms of like, I don't know, what actual malfeasance or anything else shady?
The short answer is no. I mean, I think that's been a lingering sort of challenge to the reporting. I think, you know, certainly people in King Cove are really quick to blame this really colorful seafood industry player, Roger May, who's like a very wealthy, you know, kind of flamboyant guy who produces Hollywood movies and hunts for buried treasure and just like seems to have all kinds of money everywhere. And actually through sort of this receivership sort of bankruptcy like process, ended up with a lot of the company's assets. But I think, you know, you kind of have everyone pointing fingers at each other. Like, I think the permanent fund points fingers at McKinley and says this was a McKinley deal. You end up with McKinley and the other of the three partners in the business deal pointing fingers at Roger May and saying it's his fault. Roger says, it's not my fault. I loaned the company a bunch of money and lost a bunch of my own money. But the fishermen, meanwhile, like, they're mad and they don't feel like there's been a lot of accountability either. But I don't think sort of we are at the place where we can conclude that sort of any one thing was to blame so much as like there was a constellation of things that appear to have contributed to this collapse.
I mean, you mentioned the fishermen in King Cove and that they would be upset by this, but it goes a little bit further than that, right? I mean, in terms of the economic impact in King Cove, and I wonder if you could tell me about that.
Yeah, so one of the major sort of reasons I think I was drawn to this story initially was that you had fishermen who went out, caught fish, or had, you know, paid to like upgrade their nets and fix things and get their boats out on the water, and we're going to go fish for Peter Pan. And then Peter Pan all of a sudden closed down the plant and said, yeah, we, you know, still owe some of these fishermen money from past catch that we bought and sold, but we don't have any money to pay them. So you've got fishermen out like tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And beyond that, this is a community that is built on commercial fishing. You know, the huge chunk of King Cove's tax revenue comes from taxes on the catch that's delivered to the processing plant there. It's like a huge employer in the community. It's like a huge sort of anchor tenant for like all these municipal services, power, water, etc. And so without it, you're seeing like families moving away, like the enrollment at the school has like fallen. You have like the potential for them to ask like the state for, you know, aid, basically a bailout. And I think sort of what is really ironic and another sort of reason I felt like this was really a story that Alaskans needed to know about was like, we kind of did this to ourselves, right? Like a state investment that like ended up going bad is now leading to, you know, maybe like the slow or not even so slow death of this community and a situation where like actually they may need to be coming back to the state for like more money. And I think that's, you know, whose fault that is and why exactly it happened. I mean, I think those are actually really important questions that like we should be asking ourselves, given that, you know, this happened, if not because of decision, public policy decisions that we made, certainly like connected to public policy decisions.
That was Northern Journal reporter Nat Hurst speaking with Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove. You can find his full story in collaboration with ProPublica and the Anchorage Daily News on ADN.com or visit NorthernJournal.com, where you can also become a subscriber.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
In its first commercial salmon fishery update for Kodiak, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced that there is a, quote, high likelihood, unquote, that the Northwest Kodiak District and the inner and outer Karlik sections of the Southwest Kodiak District will be closed to fishing from June 1st through July 5th. The early run sockeye salmon forecast for the Karlik River is estimated to be 95,000 fish, which is way, way below the established biological escapement goal, or BEG, of 150,000 to 250,000 fish. The BEG is the escapement that is calculated to provide the greatest potential for maximum sustained yield. But as low as early season sockeye returns have been in the Karlik, they are not as shocking as the crash of the Chinook run there. The BEG for them is 3 to 6,000 kings. In 2023, that number was 379 fish. Last year, only 76 king salmon found their way up the Karlik River. Anticipating similarly low returns this year, Fish and Game doesn't expect an opening until at least July. The sockeye salmon return for the combined Iyakulik River early and late runs is forecast to be 711,000 fish, which is well above the combined early and late run sustainable escapement goal, or SEG, range of between 200 and 400,000 fish. The SEG is an estimate of escapement that will provide for sustained yield over a 5 to 10 year period. So the estimated return is well over 300,000 fish over the upper level for sustained yield. Normally, a healthy harvest of sockeye salmon would be allowed as a result of such a forecast to avoid overescapement, which can cause diminished future runs. But Iyakulik River Chinook salmon escapements have experienced record lows over the past two seasons, with only 590 fish in 2023 and 354 fish in 2024. These escapement levels are far below the BEG range of 4,800 to 8,400 Chinook salmon. So, in an effort to allow as many Chinook salmon through as possible, all salmon fishing in the inner Iyakulik section will remain closed throughout the entire early run time frame of June 1st through June 15th, including the relatively plentiful sockeye. The outer Iyakulik section of the Southwest Kodiak District will also remain closed until the department determines that the upper end of the early run sockeye salmon SEG of 140 to 280,000 fish will be exceeded.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
In January, Governor Mike Dunleavy submitted five new requests for federal fisheries disaster assistance for last summer's salmon season. That includes commercial salmon fisheries on the Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak, Chignik, Lower Cook Inlet, and Prince William Sound. The state accounts for roughly half of the fishery disasters around the country over the past several years, which include a variety of species like salmon, crab, and Pacific cod. In Kodiak, fishermen harvested just over 7.5 million pinks last summer, which was less than 40% of the 10-year average. That meant last summer was one of the lowest valued commercial pink salmon seasons on record for Kodiak Island. Although the exact cause for the decline is unknown, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game cited changes in ocean temperatures and other environmental factors in the Gulf of Alaska in a report the department released in November. If the latest fishery disaster requests are approved, it's unclear right now how much money would go to the affected fishermen and communities. Dunleavy's latest disaster requests are currently listed as pending, according to NOAA Fisheries website, along with the 2023 North Alaska Peninsula Drift Gillnet Salmon Fishery and the 2024 Kotzebue District Salmon Fishery. The U.S. Secretary of Commerce has 120 days to acknowledge they've received them and then make a determination on each disaster request. A recently passed federal law called the Fishes Act requires that after a disaster is approved and a spend plan from the state is received, then the secretary must disperse the funds within 90 days. Meanwhile, the nearly $18 million from the 2020 Gulf of Alaska Pacific cod fishery disaster has yet to be distributed to affected fishermen.
Do
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides more than 50,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
Hello, Americans, I'm Paul Harvey, Jr. 'Twas the Monday night before Christmas, this last Christmas past, and all through the house not a creature was stirring. Clay Campbell was cozied up in his favorite chair in front of the TV. In his hometown, Garden City, Kansas, all was calm, all was bright. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter that Clay rose from his chair to see what was the matter. He went to the door. And there, sitting at the threshold, looking plaintively up at Clay, was a stray, a dog who seemed very lonely and very lost and very hungry and very afraid. Clay bent down to pet him, asked, "What's your name, fella?" The animal kept looking up at him in hopeful silence. No way was Clay going to turn him out on a cold winter night, but the dog just stood there. So Clay grabbed him by the neck fur, pulled him into the warm living room. He was a calm and gentle creature, in some ways seemed more a puppy than a full-grown whatever he was. Clay stroked his damp coat. No collar. "Where's your home, boy?" Apparently now his home was here. Clay went to the kitchen to get him some food. While he was gone, his visitor, as if to say, "I won't be any trouble," went to the hallway and curled up in a corner. Clay found him there, and there he stayed, warm and content. 3 hours later, Clay yawned and turned off the TV. Time for bed, time to take his new friend out to a comfortable backyard shed for the night. So once again, he took the big old boy by the scruff of his neck and led him off. "I'll leave you plenty of food and water," Clay promised. And just before he closed the door, he called back into the darkness, "I'll try to find your master in the morning." But this is the rest of the story. Once upon a time, there was a fearsome creature vilified in fairy tales, hated and hunted in real life. Once upon a time, there was a dreaded predator who came to symbolize ruthless cunning. So feared was he, in fact, that the folklore of innumerable cultures describes him in supernatural proportions. Yet the human apprehension of this animal, we now know, is largely irrational, something traceable to the very fairy tales in which it was so frequently and so unfairly maligned. The big, cold, hungry puppy that showed up on Clay Campbell's doorstep last Christmas is just one more example. For that animal was no puppy, was not even a dog. He just seemed that way to Clay. Certainly nothing like a fugitive from the local zoo, which he was, considered so dangerous by authorities that they had ruled out capture alive. That is, until Clay dragged him into his home, petted him, and fed him, only to learn the following morning that he was returning to its rightful owners, safe and sound, a full-grown 120-pound timber wolf. And now, you know the rest of the story.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Tim Rocky. The Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race has a new champion. Jesse Holmes raced into Nome just before 3 a.m. this morning, winning his first Iditarod on the longest trail ever. Hundreds of fans lined the finish chute, cheering and ringing cowbells. Five-year-old sled dogs Polar and Hercules led the team under the burled arch. Holmes jumped into the crowd to hug fans. He praised his dogs.
I feel like this team, the way I had them set up and the way I trained and the strategy I had on the normal route, I feel the potential was there to win by half a day with them,
Holmes is originally from Alabama and now lives in Interior, Alaska, where he says he works as a carpenter. He starred on the reality TV show Life Below Zero. He notched his first Iditarod victory on his eighth try. He described the moment as magical.
I have nothing to stop smiling about, I have everything going for me, and I should never feel a down moment in my life. If I died tomorrow, I'd just die the happiest man.
Race officials presented Holmes with a check for $57,200. Holmes said he wasn't sure he'd win until he was just outside of Nome. This year's race was a game of leapfrog between him, Matt Hall, and Paige Drobny, who traded the lead down the trail, all chasing their first Iditarod victory. Holmes described Hall and Drobny as great competitors. They live not too far from one another in the interior. Holmes and Hall have been friends for decades, and Holmes said it felt surreal that they're now first and second in the Iditarod.
I yelled across the ice. I was on a parallel trail. I go, man, 16 years ago in Eagle, can you believe this? Like, here we are, we're leading the Iditarod. And it was a real cool moment between us.
Hall was about 3 hours behind Holmes on Friday, followed by Drobny. The state of Alaska is still facing a significant budget deficit despite a revised state revenue forecast published Wednesday by the Alaska Department of Revenue. The Alaska Beacon reports for the 2025 fiscal year, the Department of Revenue is estimating $6.23 billion in general purpose revenue, about $30 million less than a prior forecast from the fall. And as a result, the state is looking at a $200 million deficit in the current fiscal year, under spending previously proposed by Governor Mike Dunleavy. Lawmakers are expected to edit the governor's spending plan before adjourning the current legislative session, but it isn't clear how that deficit will be resolved. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach for your financial needs, from banking and loans to investments and more, helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. More at fmbalaska.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Tim Rocky. The number of Alaska Native language speakers has been declining over the years, including speakers of Aleutic. But a new language class that's live-streamed from the Kodiak Archipelago community of Port Lions aims to combat that trend locally. KMXT's Davis Hovey has more.
Jamai Kuyana Teluji, hello and welcome. Thank you all for coming to another episode of King's Corner.
Every Thursday, students from the school in the native village of Port Lions discuss Aleutic culture and language. That's in preparation for class lessons and conversations in Aleutic that are live streamed online twice a month. It's the Port Lions students' first time speaking their native language within school through the Aleutic culture class. That includes practicing everything from weather reports to animals and place names in Aleutic. Jess Egemeyer II, who works for the native village of Port Lions, teaches the class.
I really saw a need for content that was focused on the local community and that would include current events happening in the village and at the school, a local safety bulletin, the weather forecast as you've seen.
The Port Lions School is K through 12th grade and has 26 students total, and the Aleutic Culture class is a multicultural elective under the Kodiak Island Borough School District's curriculum with support from the school's head teacher.
Port Lions is Mashik-Shehuk.
Mashik-Shehuk.
Mashik-Shehuk. Yuzinki is Ushinok.
Very good.
Egemeyer says the live stream, which is called King's Corner after the school's mascot, is a product of elders and the previous generation laying the groundwork for language revitalization in Port Lions and around Kodiak Island. That multi-year-long effort by multiple organizations and individuals has led to Aleutic textbooks, digital audio recordings of native speakers, and language courses for college students or even adults.
It means a great deal that we are able to provide that language learning to the next generation. It's so important to, if we don't teach our children now, this is how languages die, and it's unfortunately not uncommon.
Alaska Native languages in general are at risk of being lost or going extinct, as elders who speak the language are passing on, along with the lasting harm caused by colonization and the boarding school era, as documented by the Aleutic Museum. For Koniag or Kodiak Aleutic, which is the dialect mainly spoken in the Kodiak Archipelago, less than 20 fluent first language speakers are still alive today. Egemeyer himself grew up speaking the language with his grandmother, Sophie Katelnikov Shepherd, who died in 2021. They both were a part of Kodiak's language revitalization effort more than a decade ago. One of the ways to continue to keep the language alive is through teaching the next generation and new speakers, Egemeyer says, and the native village of Port Lions is hopeful that the classes at the school will help both native and non-native students contribute to the preservation and promotion of Aleutic culture. The live stream also has the potential to reach far beyond the community or even the island to share the language and culture with the rest of the world. Egemeyer says the school has tapped into Starlink for high-speed internet, while GCI's new subsea fiber line still hasn't quite been linked up to the village. Egemeyer says the class will go through the rest of this semester, and he hopes to continue it this summer and next school year, too.
We say in Aleutic, Tunk Chukumgin Chali, I will see you again.
Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Havi.
This is Alaska Public Media.
It's a beautiful morning.
Good morning, everybody out here in southwest Alaska. Another beautiful day. A little bit of wind and no rain. Seat of my ATV was even dry this morning. What a treat. Another day in paradise. Okay, we'll start out with Farron Young with Busted. And after that, George Strait with Does Fort Worth Ever Cross Your Mind? And then George Jones with The Race Is On. All coming out, John KSDP.
are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter pound, and I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay, a big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The cow is gonna haul my belongings away, and I'm busted. Well, I went to my brother to ask for a loan, 'cause I was busted. I had to beg like a dog for a bone, but I'm busted. My brother said there ain't a thing I can do. My wife and my kids are all down with the flu, and I was just thinking about calling on you, and I'm busted. A man can go wrong when he's busted. The food that we can last summer is gone, and I'm busted. Well, the fields are all bare, and the cotton won't grow. Me and my family gotta pack up and go, but I'll make a living just where I don't know, 'cause I'm busted.
Him in Dallas, and I know
As keep going, there, George Jones with the races on, and then Buck Owens and his Buckaroos with second fiddle. After that, Alan Jackson with She's Got the Rhythm, and here's George Jones.
I feel tears welling up, calling deep inside, like my heart sprung a big break. And the stab of loneliness, sharp and painful, that I may never shake. Now you might say that I was taking it hard since you wrote me off with a call. But don't you wager that I'll hide the sorrow when I may re-ride down and bow. Now the race is on and here comes pride up the backstretch. Heartaches are going to the inside. My tears are holding back. They're trying not to fall. My heart's out of the running. True love scratched for another's sake. The race is on and it looks like heartaches. And the winner loses all. One day I ventured in love, never once suspecting what the final result would be. How I lived in fear of waking up each morning and finding that you'd gone from me. There's aching and pain in my heart, for the day was the one that I headed to face. Somebody new came up to win her, and I came out in second place. Now the race is on, and here comes pride at the backstretch. Heartaches are going to the inside. My tears are holding back. They're trying not to fall. My heart's out of the running. True love scratched for another's sake. The race is on and it looks like heartaches. And the winner loses all.
Second fiddle to your new love while it lasts. Just like all the others I played for in the past. Why can't I be your leader and play your leading part? Why must I always have to play second fiddle in your heart? Play. Will there never come a day when I won't have to play the part of second fiddle in your heart? Teardrops tell a story of a love that just won't die. Like an early morning paper, the news you get just part. Why must I always have to play second fiddle in your heart? Play, fiddle, play. Will there never come a day when I won't have to play the part of second fiddle in your heart?
This old bar stool's feeling high as I started sinking lower. Minute that she walked right through that door. Not long ago I held her like a fool. I went and left her. Now she's with somebody new out on that floor. And she's got the rhythm and I got the blues. And she's showing me how much I had to lose. With her every look
telling me I'm over you. She's got the rhythm and I got the blues. Yeehaw. It's getting louder as my heart keeps beating faster. She spells out regret in perfect time. Well, I thought I wanted freedom, but that ball and chain, I need them. But when you choose, sometimes you lose the prize. 'Cause she's got the rhythm and I got the blues, and she's showing me how much I had to lose. Move, she's telling me I'm over you. She's got the rhythm and I got the blues. Yeah, with her every little move, she's telling me I'm over you. She's got the rhythm and I got the blues.
Yeah, Texas Jim Robbins is up next with Signed, Sealed, and Delivered. After that, Roy Acuff with Not a Word from Home. And I think we have time for Eddie Crosby with Blues Stay Away from Me.
Signed, sealed, and delivered. A package containing my heart. To open, remove the wrapper, but please don't tear it apart. You tore out my heart when you left me. You left me alone and so blue. I'm sending it special delivery. Please handle with care, it's for you.
Each day I take a walk, I travel down the trail. Each day the postman tells me no letter in the mail. No, not a word. No, not a word. No, not a word from home anymore. If only I could hear one little word from home, my heart would be so gladdened, I never more would roam. The days have turned to weeks, the weeks have turned to years, without one little word from the ones I love so dear. No, not a word. No, not a word. No, not a word from home anymore. Heard from mother, she said they were okay, but something could have happened, they're getting old and gray. I'm going home tomorrow, I'm going there to stay. I'm going home tomorrow, I can't live on this way.
Back. It only took
Yeah, a little technical thing going on here. We'll start right at the top of the hour. Yeah, I cleared my screen, as it were. I got about 5 seconds left, and we'll be there. Okay.